Welcome to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg McDonough. Each week, we hear real-time stories from athletes and CEOs on how to maximize performance through an endurance mindset. Let's get started. Welcome to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg McDonough. I am super excited for our guest today. She is an author, advisor, keynote speaker. She's a former CEO of a $100 million company that sold to a Fortune 50 company. A business transition and M&A expert. She helps business owners build value and find the right buyer. The host of the Succession Story podcast, the author of the Business Transition Handbook. Please welcome Lori Barkman. Welcome, Lori.
Greg, so great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So we love talking about endurance and the endurance mindset. And Lori, I'd love to know how your endurance mindset has impacted your life unexpectedly.
I'm a lifelong learner, and I think following topics to learn has taken me to different places, whether it's travel and learning about different cultures, or it's education and working with people different than me, being in an educational environment, whether it's school or in a workplace. I find that that's the unexpected. And the biggest thing for me is understanding that I don't know it all. I can't possibly know it all. I don't even want to, frankly. I would rather find the right people. And so that's made it so unexpected and so fun.
I love it. I love the angle on this because I too am a lifelong learner. In fact, I'm really starting to enjoy reading your book and thank you for offering. We've got 50 copies here at Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. So the first 50 that respond and post a comment, I'll happily send you a copy of Lori's book. But diving deeper into this lifelong learner, give us a little bit more meat there. Like, give us an example of something that you said, oh, I've got a curiosity for, or a passion for, or just some sort of, I don't know, energy that pushed you in a direction that turned out to be something unexpected.
Well, I have a big bookshelf over there. You can't see it on the camera. And it's got a collection of books, business books, that I've had since I first started out of college. And the way I started growing the collection was encouragement from my mentor and then manager at Ingersoll Rand Company, which was my first job out of college. It was with a big global company. And then this particular role, I was in a management training program. And I was fortunate that not only every month, I kept track of it for 2 years, every month I took advantage of a learning class that was offered either because I was in this management program or I took the initiative on my own to seek out the topic. So at the time I was working in human resources, I was learning about compensation structures and conflict resolution. But then I was also learning about concepts in manufacturing. And one of the books that I had read back then was called The Goal. And you might remember that book if you're you or your audience are in manufacturing. It's a story that's not a true story, but when you read it, you're kind of going along the path of the character. And if we flash forward to 25, 30 years later, here I am with this business book collection. And The Goal is a similar concept to one of my other favorite books by John Warlow, which is Built to Sell. And Built to Sell is written in the same kind of way as The Goal, which is we're seeing it through the eyes of the main character as to what his journey is and what could he do differently. And so I connect the dots between those two books, you know, over a span of 25 years and how that's helped me today. But also, quite often when I'm asked the question, which book has influenced you? And I pick that word very purposefully, which book has influenced you in your career? It was one of the first books that I was given by this vice president at Ingersoll Rand Company, which was Influencing Without Authority. And it's a very similar mindset as It's like steward leadership, you know, servant leadership, excuse me. That's it. Servant leadership. And when I was reading Servant Leadership recently, I was taken back to this book from 25 plus years ago about influencing without authority, that it's essentially so many concepts we might have learned when we're right out of school. So many business books that we might have come across or concepts that we might have come across in our past we're not necessarily giving it the same context as we might give it today. But I think about some of these connections and what I've read or what I've learned as I've grown in my career from, you know, newbie hitting the working world to eventually a CEO and now business transition advisor and helping entrepreneurs in this next phase of their entrepreneurial journey. And ultimately, how do we see around corners? How do we stitch things together that we haven't necessarily stitched? And I find that books and learning from other people's experiences are really, really helpful. And also shows like this, because let's face it, we all learn in different ways. Some of us listen, some of us read, some of us watch, and some of us do all the above. And ultimately, no matter how you learn as an adult, you know, it's the encouragement, I guess, also tying it back to my earlier comment that we find value in being lifelong learners, right? And keeping our minds sharp, and it helps us in our practice, it helps us in our business, and it just helps us in life as a person.
So you left me a breadcrumb around servant leadership, and I'm a huge fan of servant leadership. I donate a lot of my time to an entrepreneur's organization here. It's a global organization, but there's a local chapter. And I find that the more I contribute my time, energy, and a little bit of money, the more I get out of the organization. Not with intention. Like, I don't go into it with a certain expectation for an output. But when the output happens, the light bulb's on. It's like, well, obviously that was going to happen because I've just spent 4 years as their chapter president or something. Can you give us some examples of how that's shown up in your life?
Well, one is leading a team, no matter what size team, you know, I've led, whether it's a team of two or team of five, team of 10, team of 100. I think one of the main things that teams want to know is their leaders have a way north and setting a direction, which direction is north. And now we need to get there. Maybe we don't, as a leader, set the entire course, but we're setting that ultimate framework of where we need to be and why. And I've really tried to do a good job over my career of setting that path and the direction and giving a perspective on why. People don't want to be told what to do. They want to be, they want to understand why it's important. And then they want to be part of how do we get there? One of the things in terms of my toolkit that I've just really gravitated to over the years, learned it from, I'll call the strategic planning Yoda, when I was at a big public company, we had brought in this external consultant to do strategic planning at the corporate level, public company, you know, corporate strategy. And ultimately, the division that I was in was one of the three core growth levers for the company. Therefore, we were fortunate to get his services for our particular business unit. And that's where I learned the Yoda of strategic planning. And this was a long time ago. And ever since then, I've adapted the methodology to wherever I was so that I could work with my team to chart the course and then set the why. But that it's the what and the how ultimately that gets the oars in the water, rowing at the same pace at the same time. And the alignment ultimately is what enables teams to execute with excellence. It's not, hey, we have a plan and look how pretty it is and it's color-coded and we're going to put in this binder and it's going to sit on a shelf and get dusty. And you know, also in the spirit of sort of flash forwarding, it's why ultimately I came up with the practice of business transition as a focus with business owners. And it uses the same core ideas and methodology of setting that North Star with the entrepreneur and then helping them achieve what it is they're setting out to do by creating the what, the why, and the how.
Will you go in a little deeper there on the what and the how? Because to your point, we talk about our why all the time, right? It's almost overused in our purpose and those types of things. But up until you layer the what, the how you do it, and what you ultimately produce, for me, my why hadn't come together until I layered all three of those together. I'd love to hear your perspective of how that works as a leader.
Yeah, I think just to get some terminology on the table, When folks do strategic planning for their company, it's the same idea. So we can use the same terminology just to get on the page here. The main thing that we start with in planning is the vision. And the vision is where do we see ourselves or where do we see our company into the future, whether it's a 5-year time horizon, a 10-year time horizon, and how does it feel when we've arrived? What does it look like? What does it feel like? And it starts to set a groundwork for the larger why. The other aspect of planning that I think is really important are core values. And many times a company might have core values, but no one really knows what they are. They forget. Things have changed. They don't reset them. So it's good to revisit a company's core values every now and then and try to put it in common words. So one or two words people can remember, and then define them, literally write it out. And then some companies also define a mission. So a mission is different than a vision, because a vision is when we've arrived, what does that kind of look like, right? Or what does that feel like? And it's some people say it's the big, hairy, audacious goal, whatever you want to call it, but it's this driving, can be somewhat philosophical too. Whereas the mission is a little bit more grounded in where are we now and how are we getting there? But it does sort of, again, fit together as it sets the course forward. Then from there, this is where some folks get confused in the terminology. So I'll just lay out how we've been doing it. The why can be that vision or mission. The why can also be the goals. So goals as defined as the acronym SMART. So specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and time-bound. So if someone says, I have a goal of losing weight, you would say, well, maybe how much weight and by when, you know, to try to define it a little bit more. Each goal and the structure that I've used, you know, again, many different companies, many sizes over the years, is to say, okay, well, if we're defining our goals, and we don't want too many of them, maybe 3 to 5, what are the strategies and what are the action plans? If we don't get to the action planning point, that's where it falls apart. So if you think about the why, the what, and the how, the strategy is the what. The action plan is the how. And where a lot of companies get tripped up is the goals become a how. So people have asked me over the years, well, what do you think about Google's OKRs? Look, whatever floats your boat, at the end of the day, if it works for you, great, use it. But one of the challenges that I've had with systems like Google's OKR, which is objectives and key results, is they tend to be very detailed hows, and people lose sight of the bigger picture. So I'm not necessarily saying, hey, there's one way to do this. There's many ways to do it. But whichever way you pick, be clear to define your terms with your people and with yourself, and come up with a methodology so that it's consistent and that you can keep track of it and hold your teams accountable to it. So by doing all those things and that sort of formula for involving people from a developmental standpoint and aligning the business unit towards which way is north in a language that everyone can understand, even if you weren't in the room, that way it cascades down and ultimately everybody can participate and see the connection. So I call that the laddering back.
That's really helpful. Thank you. My curiosity is taking me to thinking from the solopreneur to the Googles, and what time along those time frames and that life cycle, when does, in your experience, like the strategic planning make the most sense, and how does it change over time? Because I think what Google probably does is going to be much different than what a single shingle or a small organization is going to do. How do you see that differentiate?
Yeah. So let's just differentiate for a second too on the different kinds of strategic planning, because I'm an advocate for both. One is strategic operational planning, the growth plan for your business. If you're a solo practitioner and you have a goal to have $1 million business or an $8 million business, a $10 million, whatever it is, chances are you're getting started. You're getting your feel for what's working, not working in the market. And with enough data behind you, you'll be able to start to chart your course forward. And maybe when you're hitting that million or $2 million mark is when you see your first inflection point and thinking about how do I get to the next level. For companies that are already big, what they tend to do is at a department level, or at a team level, right? As a company like Google has so many teams and departments, they're doing planning ultimately probably at a team level, whether it's product that they're delivering, new product development, or an existing product. Chances are there's a game plan for what they need to deliver in that quarter or that year. As an entrepreneur, to distinguish it, right? That's the operational strategic plan or the operational plan to get us to achieve this year's goals or targets. What I'm referring to and what the book is about is saying to an entrepreneur, as you build your business, build with an exit in mind. And there's an end game to what you're ultimately hoping to plan, because every entrepreneur is going to leave their business one day, but very few are prepared. So you're either going to leave horizontally or vertically. Why not have a game plan for that? That's the strategic transition plan that I'm talking about in terms of using the same framework, but the concepts and the content of that plan, which is, of course, very private to you and your advisors, if it's someone like myself, you're keeping that private, right? Whereas with the operational plan, you're, of course, sharing that because you need everybody to participate with you. And it's only when you're ready to share it and get the advisors you need or get your team on board that we'll get that going. So three goals as an example on a transition plan, and when I'm working with a client, most typically are personal, business, and financial. And we'll set the strategies and action plans underneath each of those three because they're kind of the core pillars of transition planning. And they give a wonderful way to branch out and personalize the plan based on the entrepreneur's needs.
I love that concept because by separating them, you can take different approaches and it allows, I suspect, for sort of the control of the emotion of the conversation, right? Because this is your baby. You don't want to sell it, but you do. Lori, what are some common roadblocks for entrepreneurs to create their transition plan, their strategic transition plan?
Well, you named a big one, which is really a transition mindset that they don't have it. They're happy where they are. They feel fulfilled. They work in this business. They are part of this business. They created it, or they are their daily. It's their daily life, right? Their identity is very much tied to the business. The financial stream of income is very strong for some, or putting it a different way, it's their only source of income. And so there's a dependency, there's a codependency. The business is very dependent on them. And a lot of cases that this is a very owner dependent business. And then the flip of that is that identity piece and the owner is very dependent on the business, whether financially or otherwise. That's a very, very big part of readiness. The personal readiness side is how we see ourselves. How can we start to see ourselves separate from the business? So some key questions. How many hours a week are you working? Who's your social network? Are they primarily people in your business, outside of your business? Is your name on the door? There's lots of questions like that that help us understand, well, what might be an issue related to identity? And the personal planning is where we start. So as I mentioned earlier, the three, three core pillars of this process, personal readiness and what might be holding us back is a big part of it. When I do workshops or keynote presentations, I ask the audience, when I say the word transition, what comes to mind? And the words that I get, I have it in the book. I kept track of all the workshops that I had done and I talked to hundreds of entrepreneurs and it was really interesting to see the variety of words that I got back over the years. And not only do we get the list, but then I ask you as an extra key exercise in this book, and I think it's the very first chapter because I just find this transition mindset concept so important, is I ask you to put it in three buckets, one of three buckets. Is it a positive connotation to you, a negative connotation to you, or neutral? So let's just take an example. Let's say the word change. Maybe I think that that has a positive connotation, and Greg, you feel like that's negative. Right. So that how we feel about it is in the eye of the beholder. And if we go back to our Psych 101 class from college, if you remember taking a Psych 101 class, one of the concepts is cognitive dissonance. So if you find yourself at a political rally where you do not inherently believe in the cause and you're standing there, your body will reject being there. It's your mind is preventing you from saying, wait a minute, what am I doing here? And you're probably going to get out of there. It's the same idea with having a transition mindset. If you yourself are resistant for whatever reason to wanting to do something different with your life or something different with your business or letting someone run the business that's different than you, either as an owner or manager, you're not going to participate in the process. So as a consequence, what happens, right? If you feel negative about it, you're not going to make the time and you're going to keep kicking the can. And Greg, one of the other things I always say is you can't do exit planning when you're exiting. Mm-hmm. It's too late. So another reason why a lot of companies don't sell in the lower middle market or don't have a successful transition is because they've waited so long that they don't have a transferable business that another buyer is willing to either pay for or pay enough for from what the seller thinks it should be.
So walk us through that time frame between, okay, I've got a transition mindset and when the ultimate sale happens. What's ideal? What's too short? What's too long? What's a solid average time frame that you would recommend a client to say, all right, if in X amount of years you want to exit, you got to be doing this stuff now?
A really healthy time frame would probably be more than 10 years. That's a very healthy time frame. As we get closer in and we say 7 years, 5 years, 3 years, when you map it backwards, you realize it's actually not that much time. Because it also, frankly, depends on where we're starting and how many changes need to be made in the business to achieve the end game you're looking for. It's one of the reasons why I'm creating an online course from the book, because what I'm finding is that entrepreneurs who are earlier stage in building their business are reading the book saying, oh, this is great because I'm going to build with my exit in mind. Initially, I thought the core audience of my book would be folks who are 5 years out, 7 years out, 3 years out. And they are, and they get value from it. But with some of them, they don't have as much runway to make changes. So what could be examples of changes? Well, what if you're changing your business model? You can't do that on a dime. What if you need completely change your organization structure and get different talent? And what if managing that talent also means a different reward system or incentive system to help reduce risk with your talent? What if it means different legal structure for your business to help with tax preparation and planning so that ultimately when there's a transaction, you're maximizing your net number? There's a bunch of things that we can be doing on contingency planning. Here's the tough question. If you're no longer able to serve in your business, what will happen? So the extreme question is if you died in a bus accident tomorrow, what will happen to your business? And many entrepreneurs have no answer to that. They're like, I don't know. Or they'll say, well, I guess my spouse will run it. But then what will happen in this downward spiral in your business, right? Customers will leave, employees will leave, maybe. So there's a lot of planning around reducing the risk in your business. And we call that contingency planning to start. So a lot of times, but that's where we start. You need time for that. Now, on the financial planning side, again, I gave you a big example, which is the tax planning, or what are things we might put in place to help mitigate our tax obligations if we sell the business. And of course, there's growth planning. If I'm at this enterprise value today, which most business owners do not know what their business is worth, but as a mergers and acquisitions advisor, I can say with confidence, look, it's something we can measure. Let's put a baseline together today so that you can understand what's the enterprise value in your business today. What is the goal that you have for your enterprise to be worth in the future? And if there is a gap, the more time you have to close that gap, the better. So with growth planning can be organic growth, things that you control, sales, marketing, et cetera. It could also be growth through acquisition. And maybe growth planning through acquisition is part of the strategy. We've got to give our time for that too. And last but not least is succession planning. Now, there's two flavors of succession planning: ownership succession planning and leadership succession planning. People hear the name of my show, Succession Stories, and they might think of the TV series, and that's cool. Yeah. That show is certainly layered with lots of issues, both leadership and ownership succession. The main focus of what I work on with clients is ownership succession. And of course, leadership falls underneath that. But I think those are the main categories, if that helps, you know, folks kind of understand how it breaks out.
Absolutely. Could you define the ownership planning versus leadership planning and how that is different? I think I understand it conceptually, but for the audience, could you explain that in a little bit more detail?
Yeah. So the main question is, if you think ahead, who should own your business after you? And I dedicated a whole chapter to it, just that topic, you know, who should own your business after you? And many entrepreneurs might be familiar with one type of buyer, but not others. And I find that feedback on this particular topic is really, people really like it because it opens their mind towards who might be the best fit buyer. And now who might be a best fit buyer is very subjective. It's going to be very dependent on your business and what you believe the best fit and what reasons you have for that. So for example, many owners find it exciting to think about a family member owning the business after them, you know, keeping that legacy going. Other times it's management team. They want to see the management team be rewarded and see that, you know, they know all the ins and outs of the business, so there's a good continuity there. So we call those groups related buyers. They might literally be related, or they're related enough because they know all the confidential detail pretty much. So that group is highly desirable, but it's also very niche and most likely not going to pay a premium. It'll pay a fair market value. The financial buyers is the next group. That's probably the most commonly people hear about financial buyers, like private equity groups. And financial buyers are looking for certain attributes of businesses that maybe they're looking to roll up in a certain industry. And there certainly can be an opportunity with some to have a second bite at the apple if they offer a rollover of equity for a certain amount of the deal. So there could be a good incentive for the right fit type of approach. I had a client on the buy side. I was working with him. Their firm was doing a roll up in the services industry in a particular niche. And I was doing outreach to sellers to get them interested. And we had a deal. We had a deal come through, which was great. And I think the main reason was the two co-owners were in their 30s and they were very excited about the opportunity for their employees because it gave everybody a growth opportunity. And for they themselves, they loved the idea of that second bite of the apple because they were young and hungry and they were still willing to work. For folks who were looking to retire, that might not be something that they care so much about. And so then last but not least is this third category, which we call strategic buyers. And strategic buyers are companies, they're entities. They're going to acquire your business and stitch it into their existing assets. Typically speaking, and not in all cases, strategic buyers will pay the highest multiple of your business, followed by financial buyers, followed by related buyers. So kind of in that order. And that's a big part of, I think, the education that I not only have on the show and in the book and so on, but when I work with clients and getting started in the sales side process, of course, I want to understand if anyone's approached them and why they think that that category is the best fit and what options can we create. Sometimes it's option A, let's pursue this track. Or then if that doesn't work out, let's pursue option B, let's pursue option C. I just met with a woman today. She's been trying to sell her business for the last 3+ years to private equity, and it just has not worked out. So a big part of what I talked with her today was, well, why not try the acquisition entrepreneur, the individual owner operator who's looking to acquire a business? And there's a big population of folks out there who see themselves as a succession solution for entrepreneurs who want to sell, you know, to family, but a family doesn't want it or managers don't want it or whatever reason. And they're looking for the right business to buy. It's a giant marketplace, as you can imagine, of people who want to sell and people want to buy. So again, depending on the right fit, how do we go find them? And of course, I'm going to say this as a business broker and intermediary. I think it's somewhat self-serving, but at the end of the day, I'm not the only one who says that. People, entrepreneurs who've tried to sell their business on their own say it's really tough to do that. If you don't have experience, it's not your profession, and you're trying to run your business at the same time. So my advocacy is surround yourself with advisors who can support you in your process and are collaborative. And, you know, you'll be included in the process, but you're not going to run it. You're not going to quarterback it. You know, surround yourself with folks like Call the Boat, the business owner advisory team, and someone like myself on the M&A side or on the getting ready side, I think is a great person to have on that team.
100%. And I could speak from experience as well. You know, my prior business, I bought through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy process. And after we came out of the process, it was my time to sell it. And I was trying to do it. I've got investment banking background. I've got M&A. I've been in finance. And I try to manage my process and manage the business. And all of a sudden, you've got like 18 different things to do, and they're not related. So I completely agree with your advice. Lori, the magic question, right? When is the ultimate right time to buy or to sell, excuse me?
I'm a big believer that every business should be ready to sell at any time. If that is the case, you will have a very well-run business, which is profitable and enjoyable to lead. That's the ideal. If we recognize that buyers buy on their time, not yours, it changes the mindset that a business that can sell at any time is part of the equation. There's ready to sell and there's sell ready. Part of it is your mindset and part of it is the business, you know, the business readiness. The business readiness side are all good economic factors you'll probably want to do anyway. For example, having consistent financials, having, well, you know, good solid reporting, having everything buttoned up on your financial side. Of course you would want to do that. How could you run a business otherwise? That's step one, is to have your financials in order. So of course, that's something you'd want to do anyway. And there's many other examples.
That's really helpful. Shifting gears slightly, tell us about yourself, where you grew up, how you got into this business, and then ultimately, I'd love to dig a little bit more into your book.
I grew up in upstate New York, outside of Albany, suburb of Colony. Hardworking family, hardworking in the sense that I always challenged myself to take on more. In high school, I was student senate president for 2 years, which means I ran as a sophomore and won. So it's kind of crazy. I was very involved in all kinds of organizational things as a student leader. And I did sports and was really, really busy. When I got to college, went to Cornell, and I focused on industrial and labor relations, which was a program, as I call it, the psychology of business and learning how organizations function. And it was really how I entered the workforce. And as I said earlier, I joined Ingersoll Rand Company right out of college in their management training program, which was for human resource management. I found it to be a great starting point in my career because we work with people, right? It's the people, we're in the people business mostly. And we were too. And it was a 3-shift manufacturing facility, non-union, nestled in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, between the cornfield and the high school. And my clients were everyone from the welder and the painter to the guy in the suit in the corner office. And it was a wonderful experience. And from there, I realized that I wanted to switch industries and switch professions. And at the time, really the only way I thought I could ever do that, how do I go from manufacturing and HR to technology and marketing, was via getting my MBA. And that's when I moved to Pittsburgh and went to the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon and graduated with a focus on technology marketing. And that's what enabled me to do a complete pivot in my career. And that's how I got started in technology companies. I worked in startups, and then I worked in a corporate startup at American Eagle Outfitters. I was part of the early e-commerce team, which was really exciting. And that business has been doing fantastic over the last 20 years. So I'm very proud to say I was part of the early team. And from there, just really grew in growth aspects and leadership. Managing larger budgets, managing more teams of people, until one day a recruiter that I had known over the years had called and said, we're looking for a CEO as part of a succession plan. to run a business in Pittsburgh that has two e-commerce sites and direct selling. And I was really felt like I was over my skis, like, oh my gosh, you know, am I prepared for this? Like all the negative talk of, can I do this? And the interview process lasted over 6 months. And I think the benefit of that was at every time I had to go through another hoop of another interview or another assessment test or whatever it was, and I passed with flying colors, I felt like it was validating and I should keep going. And then when I was given the offer, the recruiter said to me, you're getting the green jacket. So for the golfers out there, that's kind of what it felt like. And that was really amazing. It was a real step change in my career. I was in my young 40s to have that opportunity. And this is a third generation company. And when they were doing the interviews, they said to me, we're not interviewing you for the next 2 years. We're interviewing you for the next 20, which was music to my ears because I'd worked in a lot of startups where, you know, you don't last necessarily 20 years with a startup as it grows. You don't expect that. And I was really looking forward to that. And as things go, it was a great outcome, but it was unexpected. A little bluebird, a giant transportation logistics company, global company, acquired us. And so that, as part of an inside team, if I can describe it that way, was amazing to be a part of. They acquired the business and stitched it in. And I was part of the integration team as one of the key executives. And I stayed on a year and a half post-integration. And there's lots to say about mergers and acquisitions. But when you work with a global company like that, and they have a massive playbook of how to do deals and integrations, it was really, really cool to see that from that perspective. And that's what got me started doing what I do now, you know, just understanding the swim lane of how do companies grow? What phases of transition do they go through? Growth, innovation, and transition. And what role can I play? And I felt like as a former executive who's gone through an exit, a certified mergers and acquisitions advisor, and someone who specializes in strategy, how do I put that all together? And that's how my practice has really come together as the business transition Sherpa, that this is a movement, this is a journey. It's not one point in time. And ultimately, it's about the vision of the entrepreneur. And I am a Sherpa. I am a guide to help get them there. I don't have all the answers, but I have processes, I have frameworks, and I have a Rolodex that benefits them. And so that's the story.
I love that story. What type of client should reach out to you? What are they dealing with at the moment? When is it the right time to pick up the phone and call you?
I think
other than yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of different examples. One client I have is in growth mode. He's about 8 million in revenue and his vision is 100 million. And we are working on growing that business in a way that's going to be exponential for enterprise value. So he's an example of someone in his 40s who's thinking about this long term and wants to set the course today for a pretty big exit in the future. There are other people who I'll describe. They don't have to always be on age, by the way. I think it's also life stage. So a different life stage is someone who's owned their business for 20 plus years, and they're really starting to think about things, but they're confused. And when they think about it, it hurts their brain. They feel very alone. They're looking for clarity on some big questions that they have. And just to give a timeline, yeah, maybe they're 10 years out. Maybe they're 7 years out. Maybe they're 5 years out. And they want to work with someone like myself to get ready. And then there's someone who is a little shorter time horizon. Maybe they feel like their business is ready now. They're not going to dedicate time to it, or maybe they've already prepped or whatever the case may be. And they say, I want to sell now. I want to sell the next year. I want to sell the next two. If I hear within three, that actually translates to get ready to sell now, because it's amazing how time flies when you're prepping all this stuff. So, you know, the shorthand on that would be 1 to 3 years. And they want to really, you know, start to bring the company to market. And so those are the three types of entrepreneurs that would benefit from talking to me. And to work one-on-one would be awesome. Would love that. I'm also putting together this online course and a mastermind to help people who want to be in a group setting versus one-on-one for budget reasons or otherwise to provide more access.
Do you have a sense of when the course will be ready for public consumption?
Yeah, the course is going to launch in the first quarter of 2024.
Awesome. Awesome. One other question to ask you, since I've got you undivided attention. So us business owners get emails all the time from brokers and bankers and strategic buyers. And it's like, you're the greatest thing ever. My little business, it's written in this email. Any words of caution for our audience who also receives those types of unsolicited, you know, conversation starters?
Yeah, I think there's some caution. People always ask me, what do I do with these? And if you want to dedicate the time to respond to all of them, by all means, go for it. If you want to put them in a mail folder in your, you know, your email inbox and save them, do that. And that way, if you end up working with someone like myself on a sell side engagement, we can look at that folder and say, oh, is there anyone in here that we might want to follow up with? The cynic in some of us might say, well, is this even real? And when I, just from my own ethics, I can kind of comment. I can't comment on anyone else's ethics, but I'll just comment from my own. If I am on a buy side deal before a client and I am representing them to try to find targets, I say in my email that I can't say reveal who it is, of course, but I'll say I am engaged on behalf of a client to find, you know, companies in this particular sector like yours. And if a transaction is successful, they are paying my fee. So what does that say? Well, one, it should hopefully convey that there is an actual buyer on the other end of that email. When I've gotten people to respond to that note, that's the first thing they ask me is like, are you just saying that or is that real? And I say, no, I am literally working for a client. The cynic would be like, oh yeah, they're just, you know, fishing because they want me as a client. And some might do that. I don't do that, of course. And again, from an ethics standpoint, I don't think anybody should do that. Does it happen? Probably. It's just like in the old days when we had job descriptions, right? Companies would post in a newspaper, now hiring, and they'd put this engineering job out there and they would see what resumes they get back. That was a test. There was no engineering manager. They just wanted to test the market. So does that happen with these types of situations? I'm sure it does. Do I do that? No, absolutely not. So that would be the only thing to kind of be careful on is, look, you're trying to run your business. And that's why you'd want to work with an advisor to take the kissing frogs process off your plate.
Well, and I think to your ultimate point and the value that you're driving, it's also about the planning and being ready. Like if you get that email and you're not really ready and your financials are a mess and your policies and procedures aren't in line and your customers are, you know, consolidated, then you're really not in a position to sell your business. And so it's the pre-work that has to happen. And I can give you an example. My father has run two different construction engineering businesses, and the first one ended in a disagreement with his partner that got pretty ugly, ended up in a lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. The second go around, they were very intentional with how the exit was going to happen. So like day one, when they're sitting on their cardboard boxes coming up with the company name, they were also talking about key man insurance policies and other ways to build value in the business. And fast forward 15 years, it was a seamless transaction for my father. And now it's been a seamless transaction for the partners that he sold it to. And so now that same company is still out there three generations later, not generations as in family, because it's out of the family. But the interns that started 25 years ago are now the business owners. And so to your ultimate point, Lori, and the work that you're doing, it's critical. And when you're starting your business, you should be thinking about your exit of your business because it is temporary. And like you said, we're either going to exit it vertically or horizontally. And hopefully the former, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely. What a great story you're sharing. I love that story. It highlights so many things about the pre-planning and aligning the internal, and that example was the internal people, right? That was the transition solution. And it was a great solution. They were already lined up for it. So many times it gets heated, especially with family and the jealousy. There was one phone call I got yesterday. I talked with this woman. She was referred to me by a friend. She thought I was a family therapist, which I'm not, just to be clear. I am not a family therapist, and there are family therapists out there who are very beneficial to some. And this particular company really needs a family therapist. And I said, and she's like, oh, well, if you don't do that, what do you do? And I told her, and she said, well, what if we work with you on those, like, valuation, or we work with you on, you know, what if they want to acquire? And I said, look, there's so many fundamental relationship and trust issues in between the siblings and the father. I nobody's going to dedicate any time to anything that they would work on with me. So if we recall back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you remember that, right? Mm-hmm. And the base of human existence is, you know, food and shelter. And then the highest one is, like, trust. And, you know, we've got to kind of look at the reality of what we're working on here. When we're dealing with people, we're doing family, we're doing relationships. This is tough stuff, and it's emotional. And that's the other reason why sometimes things fall apart. It's also a reason why sometimes it takes longer, because we have to find solutions that everybody can live with. And that's not always crystal clear.
Yeah, you're reminding me of another engagement I was in many years ago, where it was a family-owned business, and the father wanted to sell to his sons, and one wanted to be the majority, the other one wanted to be a minority, one didn't want to work but wanted the same pay, and it, to your point, it turned into this ugly sort of, I would be surprised if the family, like, celebrated Christmas together this year because of how ugly it was. Lori, how can an audience member get in touch with you?
Well, I think the easiest way is to go to my website, and there's a bunch of things I could do there. So the website is thebusinesstransitionsherpa.com, and they can set up a complimentary strategy call with me. They can take some complimentary business assessments that are, I definitely recommend. One is personal readiness, one is business readiness. Mm-hmm. And those are available. They could also connect via the podcast to listen and download the show, which would be amazing. And of course, the book and the course are also on the website if they want to learn more about business transition planning.
Fantastic. And we'll include those in our show notes. And I will also restate our offer. We've got 50 copies of Lori's book. I'm happy to send these out to those interested. I'm about halfway through chapter 2, and it's making me rethink my business. So thank you for that. Lori, it's been great having you on the show. The lessons you've provided us about exit planning and our mindset and the strategic alignment around our why, what, and how, I think are truly very powerful for the entrepreneurial community. And I could see how working with you would be a benefit to their long-term success.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. To hear more inspiring stories and strategies around the endurance mindset, be sure to subscribe below or visit us at chiefenduranceofficer.com. Until next time, keep pushing those limits.